This is the University of Cambridge Local Examination Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, November 2001 examination, in English as a second language. Paper 3. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, center number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the tape back on. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Abdul wants to catch a boat across to an island to visit friends who live there. How long might he have to wait for a boat if he travels at 8 o'clock in the evening?
Hello, can you tell me the boat times, please?
The boat linking the mainland and the island goes every 30 minutes before 6 p.m. After that, the frequency is every 40 minutes.
Hello, can you tell me the boat times, please?
The boat linking the mainland and the island goes every 30 minutes before 6 p.m. After that, the frequency is every 40 minutes.
Question 2. It is Thursday, and Gloria is reading the notice on the door of the baker's shop. Between which times exactly can she buy her bread today?
Opening hours 6:30 in the morning until 7 in the evening, but closed for lunch 1 to 2 o'clock each day. Closed Wednesday and Sunday all day. Opening hours 6:30 in the morning until 7 in the evening, but closed for lunch 1 to 2 o'clock each day. Closed Wednesday and Sunday all day.
Question 3. Name two types of transport that Frankie and Sanjay may use to go home after the end of term party.
Sanjay, do you realise that the end-of-term party doesn't finish until 11 o'clock? How will we get home afterwards?
I don't know. The buses have finished by then. The last train is an express. It doesn't stop at our local station. We could get a taxi, but it might be expensive.
Or I could ask my parents if they could come and meet us in the car. Sanjay, do you realise that the end-of-term party doesn't finish until 11 o'clock? How will we get home afterwards?
I don't know. The buses have finished by then. The last train is an express. It doesn't stop at our local station. We could get a taxi, but it might be expensive.
Or I could ask my parents if they could come and meet us in the car.
Question 4. You have telephoned your local college to obtain a course prospectus so that you can find out what to study next year. Which extension number do you need?
Thank you for phoning Pleasant Vale College Central Switchboard. For the staff room, please dial extension 2432. For fee payments, please dial extension 2430. And for college course brochures, please dial extension 2436, leaving details of your name and address after the tone. Thank you for phoning Pleasant Vale College Central Switchboard. For the staff room, please dial extension 2432. For fee payments, please dial extension 2430. And for college course brochures, please dial extension 2436, leaving details of your name and address after the tone.
Question 5. Despina is buying a present in a department store when she hears an announcement. Why must she go immediately to the cash desk?
Customer announcement. This shop will be closing in 2 minutes. Please take all purchases to the cash desk now. Customer announcement. This shop will be closing in 2 minutes. Please take all purchases to the cash desk now.
Question 6. Magnus delivers newspapers early in the morning. Give one way in which his newspaper round is different this morning.
Good morning.
Hello, Magnus. Listen, the people at Flat 2 in Central Avenue have cancelled their papers for today. And be sure to deliver this extra paper today to the family at Flat 127 in the same road, please.
That sounds very complicated, but I'll remember. Good morning.
Hello, Magnus. Listen, the people at Flat 2 in Central Avenue have cancelled their papers for today. And be sure to deliver this extra paper today to the family at Flat 127 in the same road, please.
That sounds very complicated, but I'll remember.
That is the last question in Part 1. Listen to the interview with a former astronaut and then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening. It's now 32 years since human beings landed on the moon. Today, Charlie Duke, one of only 12 men who have walked on the surface of the moon, is in the studio to talk to us. Charlie, tell us about your mission.
Yes, certainly. I was involved in the Apollo 16 mission. It was the last of the manned moon flights in 1972. It was just 3 years after Neil Armstrong had taken one small step on the surface of the moon. I had the privilege of being the pilot of the lunar craft. We landed successfully on the moon's boulder-strewn plains on the 16th of August 1972. And then I walked on the moon.
What was it like?
Well, firstly, moon dust smells just like gunpowder. And it's so dry that it absorbs all the oils from your skin.
You named some of the lunar landscape, didn't you?
Yes, my partner in the Apollo moonwalk and I named some of the craters according to how they looked. We also drove up a mountain full of rocks and pebbles and named it Stony Mountain.
You drove up the mountain?
Yes, in our lunar buggy, a sort of car for driving around on the surface of the moon.
Mm.
Anyway, when we got to the top of the mountain, we stopped and looked around us. We could see the valley laid out below us. It was all pristine, never touched. Incredible.
Mm.
We could see the horizon, the slight curvature of the moon, and the land curving away from us, all coloured in shades of grey. From there, we saw an area named South Red Crater, and then Smoky Mountain, which had a dark, almost blackish colour. But what was strange was that here we were, standing looking miles across the lunar surface, and there was our little gold foil lunar module sitting in the middle of it all.
It sounds wonderful. What a privilege for you. Of course, you had the support of ground control and lots of computers.
Yes, but the Apollo program stretched technology of the 1960s to the limit. Our own computer had 70 kilobytes of memory. The standard PC sitting in your home has, 2,000 times as many.
Mm.
And I had a wind-up precision wristwatch, which helped me to time manoeuvres. I needed it to time the firing of the engine, which took our landing module down onto the surface of the moon. If I fired the engine a second too long, we'd have crashed into the moon's surface. If I had fired the engine 1 second too short, we'd still be floating around in space somewhere.
Precision timing. Do you think that there will ever be manned space missions again, or will we continue to rely on computers for space probes?
Well, I don't know what will happen, but I know that manned spaceflight is very important. It gives us a challenge. Probes are very important, long-lasting, reliable and inexpensive, but a probe cannot react with emotion about what it finds.
Humans spot the unexpected.
Absolutely. When we went into space and first looked back at Earth, it was wonderful. I was 16,000 miles away when I first looked back.
And what did you see?
The whole circle of the Earth. You can only see that from space. It was beautiful. The colours were so vivid, and the snow and the clouds were the whitest white. The land was shades of brown, and the oceans were crystal blue. It was breathtaking.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening. It's now 32 years since human beings landed on the moon. Today, Charlie Duke, one of only 12 men who have walked on the surface of the moon, is in the studio to talk to us. Charlie, tell us about your mission.
Yes, certainly. I was involved in the Apollo 16 mission. It was the last of the manned moon flights in 1972. It was just 3 years after Neil Armstrong had taken one small step on the surface of the moon. I had the privilege of being the pilot of the lunar craft. We landed successfully on the moon's boulder-strewn plains on the 16th of August 1972. And then I walked on the moon.
What was it like?
Well, firstly, moon dust smells just like gunpowder. And it's so dry that it absorbs all the oils from your skin.
You named some of the lunar landscape, didn't you?
Yes, my partner in the Apollo moonwalk and I named some of the craters according to how they looked. We also drove up a mountain full of rocks and pebbles and named it Stony Mountain.
You drove up the mountain?
Yes, in our lunar buggy, a sort of car for driving around on the surface of the moon. Anyway, when we got to the top of the mountain, we stopped and looked around us. We could see the valley laid out below us. It was all pristine, never touched. Incredible. We could see the horizon, the slight curvature of the moon, and the land curving away from us, all coloured in shades of grey. From there we saw an area named South Red Crater, and then Smoky Mountain, which had a dark, almost blackish colour. But what was strange was that here we were, standing looking miles across the lunar surface, and there was our little gold foil lunar module sitting in the middle of it all.
It sounds wonderful. What a privilege for you. Of course, you had the support of ground control and lots of computers.
Yes, but the Apollo program stretched technology of the 1960s to the limit. Our own computer had 70 kilobytes of memory. The standard PC sitting in your home has, 2,000 times as many. And I had a wind-up precision wristwatch which helped me to time manoeuvres. I needed it to time the firing of the engine, which took our landing module down onto the surface of the moon. If I fired the engine a second too long, we'd have crashed into the moon's surface. If I had fired the engine 1 second too short, we'd still be floating around in space somewhere.
Precision timing. Do you think that there will ever be manned space missions again, or will we continue to rely on computers for space probes?
Well, I don't know what will happen, but I know that manned spaceflight is very important. It gives us a challenge. Probes are very important, long-lasting, reliable and inexpensive, but a probe cannot react with emotion about what it finds.
Humans spot the unexpected.
Absolutely. When we went into space and first looked back at Earth, it was wonderful. I was 16,000 miles away when I first looked back.
And what did you see?
The whole circle of the Earth. You can only see that from space. It was beautiful. The colours were so vivid, and the snow and the clouds were the whitest white. The land was shades of brown, and the oceans were crystal blue. It was breathtaking.
listen to the following interview about the rebuilding of a railway in Eastern Africa. Then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello and welcome to the oldest railway in Eastern Africa, the Asmara Railway. I'm here to see the restoration work as the railway is being brought back to life. The track snakes its way up the steep mountainous slopes between the Red Sea port of Massawa and the country's capital, Asmara, in the mountains. Many veteran engine drivers, engineers, and other experts have been called out of retirement to provide the technical knowledge needed for the restoration work. Mr. Zemo, you are one of the experts. Can you tell us about the history of the railway, please?
Certainly. It's a narrow-gauge railway and was originally built between 1887 and 1928. It must have been very difficult to carve out the twisting mountain trackbed at the end of the 1800s. We always used the railway regularly right up until 1975. It was, and is, a valuable transport connection between the coast and the mountains.
What happened after 1975?
The track fell into disrepair.
Until when?
Until our country became independent in 1993, when it was decided to take action to restore the whole track and railway in order to use it fully again. It is a very major project.
And it certainly has many features, doesn't it?
Indeed. There are 30 tunnels and 65 bridges during its climb from sea level to more than 2,500 metres above sea level.
And what about the engines which you're restoring?
They mainly date from the 1920s and 1930s, but we do have some diesel engines that were built in the 1950s. They are our most recent ones. So far, we have repaired and restored 6 of the 11 steam locomotives and 2 of our 4 diesel engines. We've also got a really unique piece of rolling stock. It's a converted lorry.
A lorry?
A lorry which has been modified to run on rail tracks. We're really pleased with this. Its picture is even on one of our banknotes.
And what did you do when the railway shut in 1975?
I went home. Do you know, I'd worked on the railway for 34 years before that. And when the government decided to rebuild the railway, they called me back out of retirement. I'm 73.
Were you pleased about that?
Oh, yes. I am very happy to be a part of the restoration project. When I left, I didn't expect the railway ever to open again. I don't want any payment, and I'll work for as long as I have the strength.
Would you say that the work is progressing well?
Yes. We're halfway up the 70-mile route. Actually, a lot of local people already use the railway.
How long will the journey take?
About 3.5 hours.
And will you just carry passengers?
Yes. Tourists, really. Oh, and a little freight. Products going down to the coast for exportation. Coffee, salt and grain, for example. We hope to be ready later this year, 2001.
Mr. Zemo, thank you very much.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello and welcome to the oldest railway in Eastern Africa, the Asmara Railway. I'm here to see the restoration work as the railway is being brought back to life. The track snakes its way up the steep mountainous slopes between the Red Sea port of Massawa and the country's capital, Asmara, in the mountains. Many veteran engine drivers, engineers and other experts have been called out of retirement to provide the technical knowledge needed for the restoration work. Mr. Zemo, you are one of the experts. Can you tell us about the history of the railway, please?
Certainly. It's a narrow-gauge railway and was originally built between 1887 and 1928. It must have been very difficult to carve out the twisting mountain trackbed at the end of the 1800s. We always used the railway regularly right up until 1975. It was, and is, a valuable transport connection between the coast and the mountains.
What happened after 1975?
The track fell into disrepair.
Until when?
Until our country became independent in 1993, when it was decided to take action to restore the whole track and railway in order to use it fully again. It is a very major project.
And it certainly has many features, doesn't it?
Indeed. There are 30 tunnels and 65 bridges during its climb, from sea level to more than 2,500 metres above sea level.
And what about the engines which you're restoring?
They mainly date from the 1920s and 1930s, but we do have some diesel engines that were built in the 1950s. They are our most recent ones.
Uh-huh.
So far, we have repaired and restored 6 of the 11 steam locomotives and 2 of our 4 diesel engines. We've also got a really unique piece of rolling stock. It's a converted lorry.
A lorry?
A lorry which has been modified to run on rail tracks. We're really pleased with this. Its picture is even on one of our banknotes.
And what did you do when the railway shut in 1975?
I went home. Do you know, I'd worked on the railway for 34 years before that. And when the government decided to rebuild the railway, they called me back out of retirement. I'm 73.
Were you pleased about that?
Oh, yes. I am very happy to be a part of the restoration project. When I left, I didn't expect the railway ever to open again. I don't want any payment, and I'll work for as long as I have the strength.
Would you say that the work is progressing well?
Yes. We're halfway up the 70-mile route. Actually, a lot of local people already use the railway.
How long will the journey take?
About 3.5 hours.
And will you just carry passengers?
Yes. Tourists, really. Oh, and a little freight. Products going down to the coast for exportation. Coffee, salt and grain, for example. We hope to be ready later this year, 2001.
Mr. Zemo, thank you very much.
Listen to the following interview with a sleep researcher and then indicate which of the statements below is true or false by putting a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Tiredness is often described as the modern condition. As countries have grown richer and busier, so sleep and sleeplessness have become more important to us. Many disasters across the world have been attributed to tiredness, and a World Federation of Sleep Research Society has been set up in order to carry out extensive research into sleep. Sandy Thorpe from the Society is here with us today in the studio. Sandy, what do we actually know about sleep? What is it actually for?
It has been said that sleep allows us to progress through time without injury. All that means is that sleep refreshes us, and that our bodies need sleep physically in order to be able to cope with the harsh demands of life. In answer to your question, we don't actually know a lot of concrete facts about sleep, despite our research. We know that women sleep for half an hour longer than men, and that older people require less sleep, but that's about it. We know also that eye movements during sleep are related to dreams, and that, like other mammals, we sleep according to a natural daily cycle in a specific attitude. We usually lie down, don't we? When we're asleep, we switch between 4 stages of sleep, from shallow to deep sleep. Dreams occur during our lightest sleep. Factually, that's about it.
What about all those theories like sleep before midnight is worth more than sleep after midnight?
Fallacy. It has been disproved in experiments. The actual time of sleep plays no part in its effects, really.
Okay, but we do know some historical facts about sleep, don't we?
Before artificial light was invented, households went to sleep early in the evening and had what was called their first sleep. They then awoke after midnight for a while before sleeping again until dawn. This sort of pattern still happens in some communities today, where the threat of wild animals or the need to look after a fire is of the utmost importance. You find this in some societies in New Guinea and near the Amazon, for example.
Do we need more sleep, do you think?
Some people do, yes. We tend to cut back on sleep when we're busy. We get up earlier to accomplish more. We leave home very early to avoid the rush hour.
Is that a problem, then?
Well, it can be. Often drivers on motorways are vulnerable very early in the morning. They can fall asleep at the wheel.
How can we help this situation?
Never drive when you're very tired. Take a rest every couple of hours. Coffee helps too. Research shows that 2 cups of coffee, even after no sleep at all, can make you a safe driver for half an hour.
And what would your advice be to those of us who wake up feeling dreadful even after a good night's sleep, when we think we should be feeling happy and full of energy?
Oh, don't worry about it. Loads of us feel dreadful when we wake up. Have a couple of cups of coffee.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Tiredness is often described as the modern condition. As countries have grown richer and busier, so sleep and sleeplessness have become more important to us. Many disasters across the world have been attributed to tiredness, and a World Federation of Sleep Research Society has been set up in order to carry out extensive research into sleep. Sandy Thorpe from the Society is here with us today in the studio. Sandy, what do we actually know about sleep? What is it actually for?
It has been said that sleep allows us to progress through time without injury. All that means is that sleep refreshes us, and that our bodies need sleep physically in order to be able to cope with the harsh demands of life. In answer to your question, we don't actually know a lot of concrete facts about sleep, despite our research. We know that women sleep for half an hour longer than men, and that older people require less sleep, but that's about it. We know also that eye movements during sleep are related to dreams, and that, like other mammals, we sleep according to a natural daily cycle in a specific attitude. We usually lie down, don't we? When we're asleep, we switch between four stages of sleep, from shallow to deep sleep. Dreams occur during our lightest sleep. Factually, that's about it.
What about all those theories like sleep before midnight is worth more than sleep after midnight?
Fallacy. It has been disproved in experiments. The actual time of sleep plays no part in its effects, really.
Okay, but we do know some historical facts about sleep, don't we?
Before artificial light was invented, households went to sleep early in the evening and had what was called their first sleep. They then awoke after midnight for a while before sleeping again until dawn. This sort of pattern still happens in some communities today, where the threat of wild animals or the need to look after a fire is of the utmost importance. You find this in some societies in New Guinea and near the Amazon, for example.
Do we need more sleep, do you think?
Some people do, yes. We tend to cut back on sleep when we're busy. We get up earlier to accomplish more. We leave home very early to avoid the rush hour.
Is that a problem, then?
Well, it can be. Often drivers on motorways are vulnerable very early in the morning. They can fall asleep at the wheel.
How can we help this situation?
Never drive when you're very tired. Take a rest every couple of hours. Coffee helps too. Research shows that 2 cups of coffee, even after no sleep at all, can make you a safe driver for half an hour.
And what would your advice be to those of us who wake up feeling dreadful even after a good night's sleep, when we think we should be feeling happy and full of energy?
Oh, don't worry about it. Loads of us feel dreadful when we wake up. Have a couple of cups of coffee.
Listen to the following interview about man-made diamonds, then indicate whether each statement below is true or false by putting a tick in the correct column. You will hear the interview twice.
The famous James Bond film tells us all that diamonds are forever. But now a scientist has found a way to make them last forever, by manufacturing them himself. Dr. Retzer, have you really managed to make real diamonds here in your laboratory at the University of Florida?
Well, not real diamonds, as they are made naturally in the core of the earth. We like to call these cultured diamonds. They're man-made diamonds. Look, these are our trial diamonds. They're already big enough to be made into jewellery.
But surely a jeweller would be able to tell the difference between man-made and real diamonds.
No one will be able to tell the difference between these diamonds and nature's, unless they own a very powerful microscope. Look at these diamonds. Ah, they have such beautiful colours and perfect shapes.
Oh, they certainly are very convincing.
Actually, they're even better than natural diamonds. Here in the laboratory, we can improve and choose the colour, shape and quality of each diamond.
How do you make them, then?
They're made in these huge round steel cauldrons. Each container is 1 metre across and 1.5 metres tall.
Uh-huh. So these are the diamond makers. They look very heavy.
Yes, they each weigh 2.5 tons. The actual diamond grows right in the core of the cauldron, in a tiny space not much bigger than a thimble.
How did you know how to do this?
I'm a professor of crystallography. That means that I study the structures of crystals. I know that diamonds are pure carbon crystal, and so I make them from graphite, which is another form of carbon. Industrial diamonds are usually made in this way. Did you know that diamonds are the hardest substance known? That's why they have so many industrial uses.
You make it sound so easy.
It is. All we need to add is something to speed up the process. A temperature of 1,700 degrees centigrade and a huge, enormous pressure.
A bit like the conditions at the centre of the Earth where diamonds are really made.
Exactly. But natural diamonds take a few billion years to make. Mine only take 5 days.
Yes, but your diamonds aren't real. Surely people will still prefer to have the real thing, made naturally over those billions of years.
Yes, of course, if they can afford them. Our man-made diamonds will be a fraction of the price of natural diamonds.
I'm not convinced about that. Anyway, tell us about your previous crystal-growing experience.
I've grown crystals in space during 4 space shuttle missions.
Very impressive. How do you see the future of your diamonds, then? Just as commercial jewellery? Or are there other uses for man-made diamonds?
Yes. Many synthetic diamonds are already used in industry in cutting, grinding and polishing machines. You know the silicon chip that is found inside computers?
Uh-huh.
Later, in the 21st century, that may well become a diamond chip.
So you'll go into business and mass-produce these huge steel diamond makers?
Yes. We have already been asked for 200 machines.
Dr. Retzer, congratulations, and our very best wishes for the future with your diamonds.
Now you will hear the interview again.
The famous James Bond film tells us all that diamonds are forever. But now a scientist has found a way to make them last forever, by manufacturing them himself. Dr. Retzer, have you really managed to make real diamonds here in your laboratory at the University of Florida?
Well, not real diamonds, as they are made naturally in the core of the Earth. We like to call these cultured diamonds. They're man-made diamonds. Look, these are our trial diamonds. They're already big enough to be made into jewellery.
But surely a jeweller would be able to tell the difference between man-made and real diamonds.
No one will be able to tell the difference between these diamonds and nature's, unless they own a very powerful microscope. Look at these diamonds. They have such beautiful colours and perfect shapes.
Oh, they certainly are very convincing.
Actually, they're even better than natural diamonds. Here in the laboratory, we can improve and choose the colour, shape and quality of each diamond.
How do you make them, then?
They're made in these huge round steel cauldrons. Each container is 1 metre across and 1.5 metres tall.
Uh-huh. So these are the diamond makers. They look very heavy.
Yes, they each weigh 2.5 tonnes. The actual diamond grows right in the core of the cauldron, in a tiny space not much bigger than a thimble.
How did you know how to do this?
I'm a professor of crystallography. That means that I study the structures of crystals. I know that diamonds are pure carbon crystal, and so I make them from graphite, which is another form of carbon. Industrial diamonds are usually made in this way. Did you know that diamonds are the hardest substance known? That's why they have so many industrial uses.
You make it sound so easy.
It is. All we need to add is something to speed up the process. A temperature of 1,700 degrees centigrade and a huge, enormous pressure.
A bit like the conditions at the centre of the Earth where diamonds are really made.
Exactly, but natural diamonds take a few billion years to make. Mine only take 5 days.
Yes, but your diamonds aren't real. Surely people will still prefer to have the real thing, made naturally over those billions of years.
Yes, of course, if they can afford them. Our man-made diamonds will be a fraction of the price of natural diamonds.
I'm not convinced about that. Anyway, tell us about your previous crystal-growing experience.
I've grown crystals in space during 4 space shuttle missions.
Very impressive. How do you see the future of your diamonds, then? Just as commercial jewellery, or are there other uses for man-made diamonds?
Yes. Many synthetic diamonds are already used in industry in cutting, grinding and polishing machines. You know the silicon chip that is found inside computers?
Uh-huh.
Later, in the 21st century, that may well become a diamond chip.
So you'll go into business and mass-produce these huge steel diamond makers?
Yes. We have already been asked for 200 machines.
Dr. Retzer, congratulations, and our very best wishes for the future with your diamonds.